Hey there, M4 Edge listeners. Michael here. Before we get going, I wanted to give a quick shout out to TenderBoy1, who gave us a nice review on the iTunes podcast app. Gotta love the M4 Edge listeners' handles, TenderBoy1. Thank you. If you too are interested in your 15 seconds of fame, please give us a review on iTunes. It helps other listeners find us, helps spread the word about M4 Edge. So if you like us and want to share the love, please do rate us on your favorite podcast app and particularly write us a review on iTunes. Next, a quick reminder about the Listener's Edge and the Off the Edge sections on the m4edge.com website. Listener's Edge is for you to tell us what you're into other than things on this podcast. And Off the Edge is where Marco and I share those kinds of things, including, for example, the latest Weezer cover album. Stuff that is totally unrelated, some of it, totally unrelated to the topics of this podcast. Without further ado, let's get into it with Tim Wickstrom of Presenter.
I love the idea, and it's certainly something we talk about all the time, of creating archetypes. If I want to be the Steve Jobs of, if I want to be, you know, the Barack Obama of, the Ronald Reagan of, absolutely. It's really about finding your style. There's an evolution that has to come into play that I think we have to sort of acknowledge here, which is, what is good? Who's to say what a good or great presentation is? What we do know is there are fundamental aspects that people have throughout all of business and communication said, these things matter to me because they make me feel this way. It's taking that foundation and building it from there to say, how do we now create the unique you? What's the best you?
Hi, everyone, and thanks for downloading today's episode of M4 Edge. Marco, I feel like it's been a while since we said our show's full name, and since this episode is about a company that helps people hone their public speaking skills, I think we should give it a go. Welcome to Macro.
Micro.
Michael.
Marco. And
Startups at the Edge. I feel like we've gotten better at this since the beginning. Today, we talk to Tim Wickstrom, co-founder of Presenter. That's Presenter without the final E, Presenter. Presenter leverages the power of AI to improve your presentation skills. So even if you have zero interest in technology, you must listen to this episode.
Yes, this really is something that impacts everyone. Many of us know the unpleasant experience of cold sweat and paralyzing anxiety before giving a presentation to an audience. But even if you never have to engage in public speaking, just think how many times at work or in your personal life you have to convey an idea or persuade someone of your point of view.
And here's one depressing fact that emerged early in our conversation with Tim. What you have to say will often matter less than how you say it. You probably suspected it already from your experience on social media. But Tim has some striking points from a much more serious and high-stakes game, venture capital investing.
Tim argues that Presenter can be your personal coach. The artificial intelligence will listen to your presentations and rate your tone, your rhythm of delivery. It will even report back to you the 20 words you use most frequently, making you aware of filler words that are probably second nature to you, but might sound quite annoying to others. You know, it's like when Michael talks about robots and he's like, they will take all our jobs. And I'm like, no way, there will be new jobs created. And he's like, not this time. And I'm like...
Right. It's not just that it rates your quality. It just rates how annoying you generally are. But okay, we've got the picture. But this brought up an interesting set of issues in our discussion with Tim. Like, what is a good presenting style? Does it depend on your audience? Does it depend on your style and personality? And is it culture specific?
And that's where we talk about that great old movie, A Fish Called Wanda, and where Michael gives his impression of an NBC broadcaster. But we also get into the importance of body language, the impact of posture on your voice, and Bill Clinton's pointing thumb thing.
What I'd really like, Marco, is your impression of Kevin Klein doing his Italian.
You'll have to pay extra for that.
We have an intense discussion on form versus substance and whether innovations like Presenter could swing the balance even more in the wrong direction.
This debate carries through into the discussion that Michael and I had after the interview. So stick around for that. It's worth it. We even get to debating whether a bot would sit through an entire State of the Union address or just walk out in the middle of it.
But seriously, Presenter is already being deployed by a number of companies. Its big advantage is that it offers personalized coaching at scale, so it could impact the interpersonal skills of a large number of people and potentially impact the work environment itself.
No matter which industry you are in, many of the issues we discussed today will speak to you directly. So we'd love to hear what you think. Drop us a message through our website, www.m4edge.com. That's M, the number 4, edge.com. Enjoy the episode.
So Tim Wickstrom of Presenter, welcome to M4Edge.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Welcome, Tim. And it's really good to see you again.
Thanks. You as well. It's been a while.
You want to explain how you guys first met?
Yeah. So Tim and I met once at an event organized by the foundation of Autodesk, the software company. They had organized an event bringing together some top startup companies and some external thinkers, and I was one of the external thinkers somehow, with the benefit of, for us externals, of listening to the presentations of people like Tim and his colleagues in the startup world. And on the other side, we could give comments, participate in the discussion, act as mock advisors in internal board discussions. It was a fantastic experience. Everybody involved was very, very impressed by the quality of the presentations. I remember the discussion we had with Tim was especially intense, engaging, and especially interesting. So I was very keen to have Tim on our show, and I'm very grateful for Tim having accepted to be here.
Well, thank you. I got to say my 2 cents. Marco is very kind about this. He was generous and wonderful as a mock board member, and there were other sites that just grilled you. So that's the interesting part of that experience.
I would bet, actually, that for reasons that will become clear to the listeners in a moment, that you guys probably had the best presentation and the most delivered generally.
There does become an expectation when you have a company that focuses on communication and presentation skills, you better deliver. So oftentimes, yes, we're the last one of the group to go because nobody wants to go before that.
Right. Well, that's good because then you have your sort of the marquee event, right?
Sure. And the expectation is exponentially higher.
So what, before we really get started in earnest, I want to point out we've had in our, you know, still young show, a nice diversity of geography from our startups. We've had a few from the Bay Area, of course. We've had a couple from DC, where I am. We're going to have someone from Pittsburgh. We had someone from West Virginia. And you are in Kansas City.
I am. I'm located in Kansas City. I've been here my whole life, and I love it here. Presenter itself is based out of New York. My co-founder, Tammy, lives in New Jersey, and we commute into the office. That's where our development team is. And at the heart of it, I'm a central Midwest boy.
Fantastic. Well, we're glad to have you, and thank you to the wizards at places like Zoom for making this sort of
thank you to technology for connecting us.
Exactly, podcast possible. So, Marco, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah. So, Tim, our standard way of kicking off the podcast is asking you, called, "Why on earth are you doing it? Why on earth are you doing this? And what is it that you're doing? Explain."
Okay, that's a great way to jump into this. A little bit about Presenter. Presenter is a software that allows people to get real-time feedback and a quantifiable score on how well they communicate. And the reason that's important is why I'm doing this. I have been a trainer for nearly 20 years, and I love it. I've loved every aspect of it. And I think what I recognize is what customers struggle with, which is there's a great deal of investment put into people to help them become better communicators, to help them find their confidence. And the struggle they experience is when that training is done or you bring talent into an organization and take up the day of work and time to teach them, the outcome basically is there's marginal improvement simply because they need that reinforcement from the coach that they experience that day of training in an ongoing basis. And that's what we set out to solve. I love having repeat clientele. I like coming back training with the same groups. And at the same time, everyone felt, why am I not that much better? And there wasn't a mechanism to give them the opportunity to practice what they learned and perfect those skills. So that's what Presenter's goal was. And mine personally, I'm out to create a world of more confident speakers. I can only imagine how many amazing ideas are left on the cutting room floor because people don't feel comfortable sharing or speaking.
So that's an excellent starting point, because normally, or sometimes when we interview startup founders and CEOs, they are occasionally involved in activities which are fairly esoteric or technically complex. And so explaining what they do and why to a lay audience can be a challenge. In your case, instead, I imagine when you're sitting in a family environment at the dinner table, you have no problem explaining what you do. And actually, since what you do is helping people improve their presentation skills, if anything, you must be in a position having to fend off requests from all over to help them.
There's a bit of a hump. Sometimes people perceive it as motivational speaking, and I get that. Once I get through that element of it, yeah, you're right. It's easily understood by most people, because most people suffer in some fashion or another at being uncomfortable speaking, whether it's in a podcast, or if you're speaking in front of a large group or a small group of people you're familiar with or unfamiliar with. We all have different comfort levels based off all of those dynamics. So it resonates for sure that everyone has their own worst presentation story, and they're happy to share them. They can rarely recall a good one.
You mentioned, Marco, you mentioned Tim explaining it to his family, and I had this image of Tim sitting at a Thanksgiving dinner table and saying, "No, uncle," or whatever, you know, your terrible political view would be much more palatable if you said it this way instead. So.
You know, there could be a little bit of that. I choose to avoid the political dynamics at the table. I will find ways to demonstrate my skills differently by changing the subject.
That's also a good technique. Yeah.
To your point, though, it's funny to use it on family. They do, you know, they are who they are, and they're willing participants. They're not going anywhere. So I trial everything out on them.
That's good. I'm sure they love that.
Sometimes.
Yeah, I can imagine that if you do give them real-time feedback when they are explaining something, some of them might react constructively and some of them less so.
Absolutely. You know, I think you've got to come into it wanting to receive the feedback and wanting to know what to do better. If you're not a willing participant in any kind of training, it's just not going to go well.
Right. No, that's a fair point. So we get, I think, the basic pitch. What about if you're pitching to a potential fund or a venture firm or whatever it is? What's the sort of razzle dazzle? What are the technical things you try to tell them to, you know, hit all of their hot buttons?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you bring that up, because we are just now getting ready to go out for our next round of funding. So I'm in that boat right now. And what I know from my own experience coaching others, but also my own experience in going out and doing that, it truly does come down to practice. It's not a complicated equation here. People often assume content is king, and the reality is that that's not true. Content is just as important as delivery. What we know to be true is if the delivery is off, if we don't manage our delivery or communication skills, such as our body language, our eye contact, pace of speech, that's the first indicator to that funding person or whoever you're pitching to assess you on your confidence level. And that is what opens the door. If you don't start off with that solid footing, the technical content you're sharing can be completely amazing, and it's just not going to be as valid. It's going to fall down the ranks a little bit, meaning that I believe everything you're saying, but the degree to which I have confidence in what you're saying will change based off how you present it and how you share it.
Right, right. And so when you're sharing, when your team is sharing what Presenter has and what its offerings are to a funder, you know, what are, you've got the skills, the presentation skills down, you're sort of a live demo in a way, yes, of the effectiveness, right? Which is nice.
Yes.
what are the things you say? I mean, what are the technical pieces that draw someone in, assuming you've already got the, you know, high level of fluent presentation that you're coaching?
You know, it's a good way to look at this when you mention funders, right? Because they hear pitches all day long. That's what they do. They sit through pitch after pitch after pitch, looking for the diamonds, you know, the platinums, who they can pull in, where the opportunities are. As we start to unfold the table here and talk about the elements that go into their perception of the person, it immediately resonates with them. They get it. Where we tend to go to after that is they want to understand the technical aspects. How do you scale this? How do you educate them? How do you push them to do it differently? It doesn't take long to move the needle to say, we know this is what you're assessing every time you hear a pitch. And it resonates. They will sometimes sit back and laugh and say, yeah, I know that to be true. One of our advisors did a very interesting study, Dr. Balakandra out of Babson University. And she did a study with VC pitches, quite honestly. It's roughly around 180 of them, I believe. And I'm going to summarize this as best I can. Essentially, what we found was the investors weren't looking at necessarily the deal points. So what is the revenue? What is the, you know, market opportunity? Those are important matters. What they really found out they were looking for wasn't what was in the deck. It was how confident was the person in what they were sharing, how passionate are they about the topic and their commitment. Those were the things that led them to choose a deal. It's not that the market size and revenue and potential buyout or selling opportunity isn't there. They just aren't the leading factors. And it was an amazing study that supports how we invest in companies and in each other's ideas.
That is a really interesting statistic. I mean, on the one hand, it speaks to the importance of a product like yours and the power of the pitch, but it also, at least in my mind, lends insight into why the VC batting averages are so terrible.
It might play a pretty good role in that. I'm not going to deny it. I think another way to look at it is when companies like myself or any startup, our number one objective is to get out there and pitch it so they hear our message. That's at the end of the day. We want them to hear the message and hear the idea. We as folks who are out there pitching it, we either do things that help make that message clear, or we are doing things that are distracting from that message. And sometimes the idea is just to be neutral in the middle, not sway one way or the other, so they truly hear the message. That comes from managing your speaking muscles.
Actually, my guess is that the reason VCs adopt this strategy of looking not so much at the numbers, but more at how persuasive and passionate you are, is to make sure that their job is not at high risk of being taken away by artificial intelligence. That's just fully human. But Tim, you mentioned the importance of scaling. So is it fair to say that one of the selling points, one of the advantages of Presenter, is that you offer this ability to train people on presentational skills almost on a one-to-one basis, but with a technology that makes it scalable and therefore that can be deployed across a large number of users?
That's 100% correct. The current model that's in place now to teach people is really the most successful models around live training. This is the way it's been done for decades. There's nothing out there that I'm aware of that has been more, that's provided more efficacy or outcome in making people feel better or more confident in how they present. But if that challenge is, that's not scalable. There isn't the opportunity to afford or to have the number of resources of a trainer sitting on every person's shoulder whenever they need it. So yeah, it's the important part here was being able to create a scalable product that best replicates live training as best we can. And fortunately, you know, there's been a lot of technological advances. AI does a lot of that, deep machine learning, building a good database of information to be able to make the proper recommendations. And that's, at the end of the day, that's our goal, is to take what happens in a live instruction and create the ultimate customized scenario where we treat you differently from the person sitting next to you based off your needs, because that's how it should happen. And that's what we do in live training.
Exactly. And it's a mobile application, right? And so if I'm a user, how does it work? I download the Presenter app on my phone, and then what do I do?
Right. So the way you can access Presenter, a lot has happened. We launched our mobile app last year where you can access it on your Apple phone and an Android. At the end of last year, we also launched a browser version. So now you can use it on a laptop device through the browser, completely accessible. When you log in, and I'm happy to say what's coming out here very shortly is an AI coach that we have built into our app. It's a really significant upgrade for us that will help guide the user through using our software. Oftentimes, learners, they don't know what it is they need to do. They know they need to do something. So having our guide, our coach, come out and interact with you, asking you what you're there for. For example, if you say, I've got to prepare for a presentation, when is your presentation? How often would you like to practice? Assessing them first, using a really true rubric that we know is successful in how you navigate people moving the dial on their skill level, that's a big element to it. So you can access it through any device. Our coach will guide you through various uses of the software, and you can always use it at will too. What's important about our platform is that a lot of folks out there will get a score. They might see their, you know, get a score for how well they communicate. That can be intimidating at some point. Oftentimes what we find to be true is it's making it competitive. I'm happy to know what my number is. It's like my sleep number. If I know that I'm at a 45, but I've been kind of resting on a 38, how do I get up to that 45? And that's the idea behind the gamification of communication skills. It's taking a soft skill that requires a human and putting it around a software solution that still feels human.
And the way it works is if I want to start practicing, I start the app and I start giving my pitch on how wonderful the M4 Edge podcast is, and everybody should tune in.
Does it come with a BS detector?
You might want to put that in as a filler word, though.
And then what happens, Tim? So the soldiers starts telling me, first of all, slow down. You're speaking way too fast. And stop using that. You keep using that word. You probably don't even know what it means. Stop using
exactly,
that word.
Exactly. The first thing everyone wants to do is know where they're at. They want a baseline assessment. So when people come into the app, they're generally recording themselves to get their very first score. And what we do is we give them an overall presenter score, but then we break it down into the elements that impact how confident someone sounds or how passionate they sound. And we focus on voice because it's your number one asset. As any communicator, the voice is what lets people know how passionate you are about a topic, how much you care about it, and how confident you are. But we break that score down into how loud you are. If you're monotone, then there's going to be some negatives around that. It doesn't really communicate interest or passion around the topic. It's just very flat. What's the right volume level for you to be? And we embed tips based off how your skill set or your score comes out. So if you have a lower score, we want to build a foundation all the way up to a mid-range score where you're now sustaining the foundation. How do we take you to the next level? And then when you hit that right volume, bingo, you've got it. It's giving them a score to give them a baseline of starting, and then moving them into a lesson plan where they can watch a video, they can read a blog, or play one of our games that makes them use those muscles in a different way to build the habit. And that's really the value out of Presenter, is you can assess and always see where you're at in the moment. You have this learning opportunity to gain an understanding in the best way you learn. We all don't learn the same way. Some learn by doing, some learn by seeing, and some learn by hearing. We cover all three of those bases so that that user gets their needs met. And then you have to have practice and get live feedback. So a user will come in and start out with their score, learn a new approach, practice it using one of our games, and then go back, reassess themselves. Did my score go up? And it's interesting. You see the variables change all the time. I'm often asked, how do I get 100? Well, you don't get 100. You can't get 100. I can't even get 100, and it's mine. The idea here is not to perfect your presentation skills. It's to constantly improve. It's to always know that this is a challenge. And anytime you change the content or the topic that you're talking about, it challenges your ability to communicate because you're thinking, you're using more capacity in your brain to think about the topic or content. And your level of familiarity, it's going to pull that attention away from your delivery skills. So you don't ever want to try and perfect them. You want to constantly improve them.
The scores you mentioned, the never attainable 100, is that a composite score of the various attributes of your speaking abilities? Or is it, 100 on volume, and you can also get 100 on the reduction of your ums and ahs and pauses, or how does that?
The presenter score is made up. It's an algorithm based off of those elements. But within each element, you can get 100. So you could get 100% on hitting the right volume, decibel levels. You could get 100% on using no filler words. But you can rarely get 100% on all three of them. So you may find that you have 100% in one or the other, and that's just to say, here's where your strength is at this time. To your point, you brought up filler words. That's one of the most sought-after feedback elements in our software, and what we really focus on is two things. We know the ones that people often say, the ums, the uhs, the so, actually. If you're younger, it's like. Like is every word. It just drives me nuts. But there's also this element of what do I not know about myself? And so within Presenter, we have a word count tracking mechanism that allows us to capture your top 20 words that you use every time you use our software and give you access to that to say, oh my gosh, I didn't know I said that. And that's not a common filler word, but it actually is for me. It's something that is coming through for me, and you can then start tracking that, and that becomes a part of your score. So that customization, making it fit for you is the advantage of that.
I just have to throw in that my older son, who we were talking about just before we started recording this episode, his new way of telling his younger brother to shut up is to say, word count, word count.
Well, there you go. Overuse of word count. Start tracking that one too.
Perfect. You mentioned the like, and this kind of brings up another set of questions that Marco and I had, and it's how to track, or how does Presenter identify terms that may be acceptable in different circumstances? So if you're speaking to a younger audience, they might not recoil as much as I do at the constant use of like, and how does Presenter deal with that? Or maybe does it not yet?
Yeah, that's a fair question. There is no one right or wrong way to do all of this. There are best practices. There are things that we know to be true that resonates across the board. That's really what we aim to provide people, is that understanding of these widely accepted elements that are critical, but not to steer you so far down the pathway to say you have to do it this way. In that example you shared, if I were practicing communicating with a teenager or you for your son, you probably wouldn't track the word like, because that's acceptable in that scenario. It's the idea that whatever you are working on, when you consider what you're trying to accomplish, you can adjust Presenter to capture those elements. If I'm really trying to not be so serious and professional and be more cool and hip like a young kid, I probably am not going to track like or so or some of these filler words that they use all the time, so that I don't sound different than them. I want to be more similar, if you will. Building that rapport, it really allows you to base it off of what your needs are.
That's very interesting, because one thing I was thinking about considering the offering of presenter is when you are giving presentations, all of us have done it multiple times, there are two key considerations. One is understanding your audience. And this we've just discussed, and as you've pointed out quite fairly, a presenter cannot simulate multiple audiences, so it can give you suggestions for a best practice. But the other element is your subjective your personality as a presenter, because a presentation style that works for you might not work for me and vice versa. But you are suggesting now, Tim, that actually presenter can give me some flexibility in working on my own personal style. So if I know that I'm a hilarious guy, really supremely funny.
You are hilarious. Let's just call that out. You are hilarious.
And I just need to fine-tune it a little bit and manage to speak. I can build my own personal style rather than presenter hammering into me just one benchmark style.
Absolutely. And I think that's partly why I say don't try to get 100%, because the idea here is that we want you to build these skill sets to the level that makes the most sense for you. For example, not everybody will have the same opportunity to reach a particular volume level. There are different ways to do that, though, to make the same strong impression. Perhaps it's having a better pace. Perhaps it's managing eye contact very differently. I love the idea, and it's certainly something we talk about all the time, of creating archetypes. If I want to be the Steve Jobs of, if I want to be, you know, the Barack Obama of, the Ronald Reagan of, absolutely. It's really about finding your style. There's an evolution that has to come into play that I think we have to sort of acknowledge here, which is what is good. Who's to say what a good or great presentation is? What we do know is there are fundamental aspects that people have throughout all of business and communication said, these things matter to me because they make me feel this way. It's taking that foundation and building it from there to say, how do we now create the unique you? What's the best you? And if the best you matches up with a particular type or a style, and even organizationally, I hear oftentimes our company culture is this way, then make it fit that way. Make it be that way for you, not what somebody else tells you you have to do. And keep in mind these elements that we've talked about, the volume, the pace, the filler words, and how you fluctuate those pieces, they play a large, consistent role in how people perceive you, regardless of the style. They are fundamental aspects. Beyond that, it's about creating the best you.
Now seems like a good moment to take a short break from our conversation with Tim Wickstrom and check in with Ricky Butch. If you didn't listen to our last episode with Evan Caron of Switch, you missed installment number one of Ricky's Reports from the Edge. Each episode, we'll give you a brief front row seat to the experience of building a startup from the ground. Ricky's a friend and former GE colleague who just recently started his own company, Loctricity. Each episode, we'll hear what he's doing, what he's learned, what challenges he has, and how he's facing them. Here's episode two of Ricky's Reports from the Edge. Ricky, welcome back to Ricky's Reports. We got some really nice feedback over social media, so people are interested. So glad you're doing this. I hope it's not too painful, you know, revealing your innermost thoughts here.
No, thanks for having me back, Marco and Michael.
So catch us up. What did you do for Loctricity in the last couple of weeks since we last spoke?
Since we last spoke, my next step was actually to find some office space to get a little bit of separation from the home. And so I just joined a local startup incubator not too far from where I live. And in addition to providing some shared office space, joining the incubator actually opens up a network of potential stakeholders. And through that, I've actually been able to form an advisor who's now become somewhat of a mentor. And so we've actually had about two separate meetings now over the last 2 weeks. And it's been great to just brainstorm with him and plot out the next steps for my venture.
Very cool.
So, Ricky, this is very exciting. And last time, you said you were going to focus on a digital solution for distributed energy. Can you explain what that really means in lay terms for those in our audience who may not be deep in the energy space? And also, who do you envision as your customers? Why would they need the solution?
Absolutely, Marco. One of the things that I know you and Michael are quite familiar with is some of the macro trends that we are seeing in the energy space. And one of these is the rise of what we call decentralized or distributed resources. In emerging markets, we see customers deploying on-site generation. So this is producing power close to where it's being consumed, driven by the reliability of the grid. And in some cases, these customers are located in locations where there is no electricity access. And so they have no choice but to deploy their own generation. And a lot of that up to now has been diesel powered. And so we have seen a pretty substantial amount of diesel generation that has gone in and that likely will continue to go in, particularly in emerging markets, to address some of these challenges. As you, Marco and Michael, are quite aware, the solar and storage costs have really come down of late. And that's, I think, made the value proposition around adding renewables, whether as a standalone or in conjunction with these diesel power units, a lot more viable. And so the digital solution that I have in mind is really to facilitate the deployment of these renewables, particularly in applications that are currently powered by diesel generation. And the initial customer segments that I have in mind are really going after those companies, small to medium enterprises, that focus on distributing, operating, and maintaining these diesel generation assets for their customers. And what I have noticed, and which is true certainly here in the US and in other developed markets, but particularly in emerging markets, is that a lot of these companies don't necessarily have the sophistication of deploying some of the digital tools and techniques that they can use to really improve their customers' operations. And so my initial market hypothesis that I'm looking to validate is there a value proposition around developing a digital platform that these small to medium enterprises that operate in distributing these diesel generation assets, can they use these tools to really improve their customers' operations? And in conjunction, is there a value in helping them deploy additional renewables where before that may have been difficult?
So Ricky, for people that either aren't schooled in the lingo of industrial Internet of Things or in power sector lingo, what is a digital platform? What is it that you're selling or hope to sell? What does it do? And what's the value that it would bring to a potential customer?
Well, Michael, a digital platform, I think in this particular instance, really is around providing a means to better understand when to deploy these distributed assets, when they are deployed, how to control them, and how to maintain them on an ongoing basis. And really, this, I think, is about surfacing data that already is being generated by these assets, standardizing the way in which that data is analyzed, and providing both the customer and the decision maker or the operator the ability to make more informed or more better decisions on how to manage those assets.
All right, Ricky, we look forward to hearing your next installment, and congratulations on moving into the new space.
And the incubator, yeah, I think the incubator is going to be an invaluable part of the experience, Ricky. As you were saying, I think it's a great way to get access to more resources.
Absolutely, Marco. It's definitely opened up some doors for me, and I hope that it continues to do so.
Now back to our conversation with Tim Wickstrom of Presenter. Before the break, Tim was telling us about the importance of developing a style that presents the best version of you, the version of you that's most natural. You said early on that voice is the number one element of a talk that people focus on.
Michael is very proud of his voice. You should.
Right. That's sort of that's. I just wanted to repeat that. That's
yeah. Yeah. No fishing necessary. You got a great voice.
Thank you. I've heard it said that in fact it's how you move and your body language is as important. And I'm wondering. So right now, Presenter is focused on voice. Is there a version of Presenter where it's focused on presence? I was thinking about this weird political motion, this weird motion that politicians use. In my memory, it's a Bill Clinton.
Here we go, politics.
And I'm doing it right now. It's sticking your thumb out over your fist, like on top of the middle knuckle of your index finger. No one ever does it naturally. It's bizarre, but somehow politicians have been taught this is the way to make a point. And, you know, but there are a bunch of those, you know, there's the sort of
hand temple class.
People won the hand temple. Yeah. There are a bunch of these that are, exactly. The bouncer. I don't know if there's any science to that, but I'm wondering if the visual presentation and whether or not you walk around, right? That's another one, is part of where you see presenter going ultimately.
Absolutely. So there were a couple of things in there that I would tag on to. The first one was, do we capture any of the body language? Interestingly enough, our very first jump into creating presenter involved the Kinect sensor. If you're familiar with the Xbox, the Kinect sensor is a piece of hardware mounted on the wall, and it supports a game called So You Think You Can Dance, or whatever, it's kids dancing in front of it. And that's actually where my idea came from. I was at a colleague's house in Brooklyn. My flight was delayed after a program. I had just worked with a client, and we're having a glass of wine, and our kids are playing So You Think You Can Dance. And all I'm watching is they're in front of the TV trying to match the behaviors on the screen. And I see them getting points and bonus points and stars flying everywhere. I thought, my gosh, that's cool. My friend says, why don't you give it a try? And no, there's not enough wine for me to dance in front of her or her. Certainly not on video by any means. But I was intrigued by the idea. And I thought, wow, that would be really meaningful, I think, especially in some industries where data, you know, is king, to give people a score versus an opinion. So if I told somebody I saw you close your body language off, they might be receptive to it. When they see it in a software, they believe it. It's the same principle. It's just provided in a very different way. So our first product, it's a PC-based software. We use it to this day, and it's a huge, huge live training opportunity. We have trainers and companies who use it all the time, and it gives you a score on your eyes, voice, gesture, and posture. And all four of those areas culminate into your presenter score. When we launched that product, that's what drove us to create a mobile app, because once they saw their scores for their whole body, their physical presence, they wanted to know, how can we continue this after the training? How do I keep driving my score? So that's one element. Yes, we do track the body. My objective is to get video in our mobile app and our browser version. Absolutely. So that you don't have that other hardware element. But for live training, it's an amazing tool. The other point that you mentioned that I want to tag on to is the impact of body language on your voice. I do believe your voice is your number one skill, because you can use it universally. You can use it in person, virtual, over the phone, in web chats. You can't always see. If I turn the camera off, you wouldn't be able to see my body language, but you can now see me. I'm gesturing a lot. I'm moving around and I'm gesturing. There is a mental connection between your voice and your gestures that help articulate the content. So you'll find, even today in our software and presenter, when you look at the lessons that we have these little 60 to 120 second micro learning videos. While presenter is assessing your voice, we still tell you how impactful your body language is to your voice. Your posture when you're sitting down, if it's slumped over or very relaxed, that impacts your diaphragm and how much oxygen you can take in, which then impacts how you sound. If you don't gesture and just lock your arms down, you might stumble through your message a little more than you normally would, because you're used to gesturing when you present. So we do bring the whole person to the experience, even if we're not capturing that data. And eventually we will be doing that on the mobile as well.
I found all this somewhat disturbing at one level, but I'll come back to this. I'll come back to my personal paranoia. But before we get there.
How have I disturbed you?
We'll get there. Before we get there, more serious question. I wanted to ask you, Tim, what is your customer base? Are you marketing to individuals, to companies? Which kind of companies or industries are showing more traction?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. And I'm really proud of the traction we have. We really, we're a B2B solution. So we're not a consumer-based product at this time. What we did was really, my partner Tammy and I really took a deep look at the customers we were serving before we started Presenter. I have a deep level of experience in biotech and pharma, and she has a wealth of experience in the professional services area, which means that a lot of our clients are pharmaceutical clients. A lot of our clients are legal firms, law firms, professional services, accounts, advisory firms. We also have some media firms as well. NBC is one of our clients where we work with them, and proud to say in our second year with them as well. So it runs across the board. And what we're starting to find more interest in is certainly in the professional services area. My ultimate goal would be able to get into education. That to me is where I originally started at with this idea. And the reason is, I believe a lot of this idea of I'm afraid or terrified of presenting comes at a very young age. We experience this while we see others presenting, and looking at their reaction can intimidate us to feel like we shouldn't do that. Or they get feedback, oh, you're not good at this, try to improve. And boy, I struggle with that, because you've got people who are trying to be really supportive, but they don't really have the competency. They're not trainers. They're not communication skills coach. So telling somebody to not fidget as much or be less nervous, what does that mean? How do I do that differently? It just leaves me feeling bad about how I do it. Solving that problem through the software is a really big opportunity. And to be able to get in the education market and help people out before they get the bad behaviors, before they get the feedback they're not doing it quite well, I wonder how that will change the way people show up, how they will, you know, be in interviews, how they might ask somebody out on a date. Like, we do it all the time. These are meaningful moments. I think there's an opportunity to change how people feel about themselves at a young age so that they're never afraid of it. It's not worth being afraid about, but it's very intimidating.
That's a very, very good point. And going back to your current customers, though, a double-headed question is, within these companies, is Presenter deployed at all levels of the organizations throughout the ranks? Do they focus on the executives? And linked to this, what is the revenue model? So do you sell a subscription or a certain number of subscriptions per company? How does it work?
Yeah, so the first question you asked, I love that question, because if you look at the traditional way in which presentation or communication skills is offered, because of the expensiveness behind it, the level of investment, it's usually reserved for certain audience members, the upper management, C-suite, those individuals. Oftentimes the people who are customer facing are the ones who need it the most, but it's just not scalable to that size of an audience. So the wide adoption of our software is something that makes me happy. We go across all levels. You will find that it's used in one-on-one coaching with executives, through frontline individuals, sales individuals, customer service. We're starting to have a lot more conversations around customer service and call centers and being able to help them. You know, I don't know how to teach empathy, but I can teach the skills that lead people to believe you're more empathetic, you know, those elements. So it does cross the spectrum, which was my goal, right? Everybody, democratize the education. Everybody should have access to it, not just a certain bracket. We do sell it by subscription. So right now we offer it in a case, in a subscription basis. It's an annual license where you sign up for it and you can access it again on any device, use it as much as you want, whenever you want.
And so your immediate customers would be sort of the HR department's training teams?
Training and development is a strong lead in. Absolutely. HR is also a good lead in. And what I find is that with human resources, what they're looking for is a use case or a test with a business group or a business unit. Maybe that comes through L&D. They want to use it to help their internal teams. And then it winds up growing from there and becomes something that HR sees as a staple to offer in a larger scale. Primarily training and development is a lead-in or a business unit owner.
When you said NBC before, I imagine that you're training the executives, not the people in front of the camera, because as you know, news cadence is very strange.
Yeah, That's a really interesting point, because that's not the case. What we are actually is a part of their talent development group, and they have an internal program that helps people across the whole spectrum of the company. This is a 5-week program that they're put into to take a nugget of an idea that they have and give them the tools and techniques to, at the end of 5 weeks, go out and pitch that idea back into their organization. And these folks are across all levels of the organization in all areas, not as you might think, C-suite or TV or customer facing individuals. It ranges. And we've met so many people across the organization that way, and it's just as value added for them, but it's not as specific as you might've thought.
And when you talk about how widely used and widely deployed this is across organizations, it actually brings up an interesting thought. And I'm wondering if this is something you're doing already or thinking about for the future. So my presentational skills are relevant. So if I'm a frontline employee, they're going to be relevant if I go and pitch an idea to a customer or try to help a customer in the field. But they're going to be similarly impactful in the way in which I interact with my colleagues, my bosses, with people in my teams. Now, we're in an environment where there is a lot of discussion about the role of implicit biases in the workplace. And I'm wondering whether presenter then is also something that could be a tool to address, make people more aware of how these biases are manifesting themselves, even make people aware of the fact that they have biases and maybe they don't realize it. Is that part of your current business model or future plans?
You know, that's a really interesting point. It's not really a part of our current model. If I were to tell you it's something I think of, that's true. Prior to starting Presenter, one of the areas I worked in with my co-founder, Tammy, as well, we met doing diversity and inclusion training. And, unconscious bias was a part of that. This is certainly a lot of areas that you just mentioned that we touched on. Ultimately, yes, I'd love that. I would love nothing more than to be able to dive into those areas. It's not necessarily on my roadmap at this moment, but it's not something I haven't thought of. I wish I could boil the ocean for sure. That's something I'd love to get into. Right now, I'm just really working to convince people that there is a score, a quantifiable score for how well you communicate. But that, you just highlighted there's lots of pathways we can go with it. There are no shortages of use cases or opportunities. That certainly is something I would be interested in.
I want to flip that question a little bit.
Uh-oh.
And I'm wondering, so you said that you've, in the latest version, I think in the desktop version, you've got an AI-based coach. And there's a literature emerging now about biases that are built in to artificial intelligence systems. And so this hadn't occurred to me when you first said it, but Marco sort of triggered this thought. How do you know you're just not training people to be white guys, right?
Yeah, that's valid. In fact, I was at a conference in DC last year, and this very question came up. It sort of goes back to my point of saying, who says great is great? Who determines that? Is that a room full of white people? Who is a part of the studies and the research that's been done? I think the point about that is that it's all been very subjective up to this point. And in order to remove that subjectivity, we have to have data to drive some of these outcomes and to measure everything equally. When I talk about our AI, if you will, what our focus is not necessarily saying this is the one right way to do it. It's more of a guide in how to use the app, not whether they've done it well within the app or not. So that element alone, it's meant to be there to help them know what they want to do or what they need to do in order to improve whatever it is they say to do. Meaning that we're not going to tell you this is the only way you're going to get better and this is exactly what it looks like. It's in order to practice, let's see where you're at now. What we know to be true about learning and development is when you get the self-awareness, then we have to educate you on some just tips and techniques that you can try on and do differently. And the tip that works for me may be different from the tip that works for you. So we have a multitude of options for you, and it rotates through that. But we know the learning process is self-awareness, educate, practice, reassess, and reevaluate your self-awareness. Did something move or change? If you feel good about it, that's what you should focus on, is do you feel good about that change? And that's part of what we built into this, is there's a little self-assessment. Did you notice a difference in how you showed up? And that's what we do as live trainers. It's not for me to say you did or didn't. Did you notice? Did you feel different? So you internalize that for yourself, not what someone tells you you should feel.
I'm going to ask another hard question, given that you suggested earlier that I was very nice. So I'm going to try to prove you wrong.
I'll take that back, but no, go for
sure.
It.
I
love our question.
I wanted to ask you, the thinking of measurements, do you know if any of your customer companies have been running any form of return on investment assessments? That is, their employees use Presenter. Hopefully, they can see an improvement in their Presenter score. Does that translate in higher sales, higher customer satisfaction scores? Are they measuring this?
Those are things that we are working on right now. I love that. And that's kind of the ultimate for us, right? Is being able to demonstrate that, that return on investment. Right now, we're so young into this. We're just building the database where we can say, what does this look like over time? Launching our mobile and web platform last year was just the beginnings of that. We do have those conversations with clients. And in fact, clients start to share with us how they look at this and how they might use it differently. When we're working with them and we work with them live and they see them, folks who have a strong audio score, if they're better at presenting virtually because their body language may be more closed off, that may be a determining factor in how they assign work groups. I just did a demonstration this morning before this call with a client who was saying the same thing. You know, our sales team, their needs are very different than the customer support team. We can see how we can use this to help them refine their pitch, for one, but they weren't really looking at it in always the communication confidence side. They were looking at it as in, is the message right? So a bit of a certification process, if you will, just for the content alone. Being able to listen to that when my team is dispersed across the U.S. and not having to do it face-to-face or schedule time, that I as a manager can log into the platform and I can see all of my subscriptions, who's using it, give them feedback when they've asked for it. Hey, listen to this recording. I think this is my best one. What would you change? And doing all that virtually and remotely, whether it's real time or down the road, that's part of the ROI. It's not just about improving their scores, but that certainly is an element. They do start to look at the scores and say, how might we deploy this person differently based off their scores?
One of the things I wanted to sort of circle back to was this notion of cultural differences. And I'm wondering, I'm assuming that right now it's entirely English language, correct?
It is for now, yes. And another common question that comes up and just came up this morning.
Does it pick up, or does the app deal well with British accents, Australian accents?
No. Italian accents.
I was waiting for that one, Marco. Come on. I knew we were going to hit that one. You know, in terms of accents, the engine we use, it does do a fairly good job of that. We haven't done in-depth testing to say how accurate is it based off of an accent. Not for our mobile version. The interesting thing I will share with you is that first product we launched with the Kinect sensor that I mentioned, we had an opportunity to use it in Quito, Ecuador, and we did a program with a client down there, and all in their native language, English is a second language, and we were able to capture very accurate data with them using it phonetically as well as we would in English. So I know that you can do it, absolutely, because we've already done that in our initial product, doing it in this version, because we are no longer depending on a third piece of hardware, a third party hardware that has a lot of that processing built into it. We're creating it on our own and we're using APIs that are out there and, you know, looking at how we better our engine. The goal here is to make this universal, not make it isolated. This is just the place we started out with.
Incidentally, if either one of you or any of our listeners has seen and remembers the movie A Fish Called Wanda,
I was just thinking
people,
of that.
People can react differently to Italian accents and other accents.
That's hysterical, Marco. I just watched that. I can't tell you how many times over the holiday. It's one of those that when it comes up, I just don't change the channel. And it's spot on.
So, before we run out of time, let me circle back to my paranoid concern. It's a mixture of fear and hope. And it starts like this.
Okay, so we haven't gotten to the hard question yet?
No. Those are coming. Okay. Those are still coming. But this is, it's harder for me than for you, I think, because it doesn't undermine in any way your business model. But my concern is the following. So you pointed out at the beginning that how you present and express ideas is as important, if not more, than the content. You made the example of the study showing that VCs assess more your passion and your persuasion than the numbers in your business model. And I've also seen separately a study that shows, to me very disturbingly, that if one of us sees on a billboard or on a computer screen a statement, the same statement in one case in bold characters, very legible, very clear. In another case, the same statement in very fuzzy, hard-to-read characters, it will change your view of whether or not the statement is true. And that I find frightening. It connects to my hatred of PowerPoint.
Text messaging.
But the idea that the form can, shall I say, trump the content is scary. And so how should I look? From this perspective, I can look at presenter in two ways. One way is positive, to say, okay, presenter is going to help anybody who has good ideas, good content, to put them forward in a more effective manner and kind of level the playing field. The dystopian view is, oh my God, presenter is going to lead everybody to focus on the form and the presentation and forget the content.
Let me address the scary aspect of what
Mark, I wasn't paying attention to what you just said. Could you say that again?
I was so entranced, I didn't get the message there either. I'm a little lost. What was that?
You'll have to listen to the podcast again and find out.
Touché. Let me clarify a little bit of what I mean by that. It's, I think that what I'm trying to share with folks is that it was always thought that if I've got a solid message and my data is tried and true and my content is on point, that that's really all that matters. That my delivery, yeah, it's important, but it's just not as important. And what I'm suggesting and what I believe to be true is that the delivery is equally important, but it's more important in the beginning. Because if you think about how we form first impressions, when you and I first met, when Michael and I talked on the phone, anytime we interact with somebody, whether we have the visual element or not, think how quickly you form that impression. You've already decided in probably 30 seconds or less how comfortable you are with that person. And that doesn't give you a lot of time to get content out. There's nothing measurable from a content perspective that's going to come out in 30 seconds that's really going to move the needle as much as how you deliver that content in 30 seconds. So when I say that it's equally important, I think it's more important in the beginning because I look at it as what's going to open the door for you. If I walked into a VC's office and they are making eye contact with me, but I'm not an eye contact person and I'm just looking down around, they're instantly going to assess that. If my body language is closed off and my voice is really soft, they're going to use words to describe me, whatever they are, right or wrong. In 30 seconds, you've banked a whole lot of words that you're going to use to describe how you feel about me. And there's no meaningful, real content that comes out other than, hello, my name is, thanks for letting me in. So I think the delivery skills are about opening the door. How much you can open the door depends on how well you do the delivery skills. Then it really is your content. Your content really does have to resonate. It really does have to be on point. I think it's where that term, there's a sleazy salesman out there, right? You know, they've got the shtick and they come in and they deliver it, but yet it could be a great car. It could be a fantastic car that you're looking at, a Porsche 911. Yes, I'm dreaming here. But if they come across in a certain way, I'm not going to get to the car. I'm just going to get to that person, and I'm not going to want to deal with them. It's about opening the doorway for people to want to hear more of your content. How far the door gets open, I think, depends on how well you deliver it.
You know, when you said earlier in the conversation, you had some, you know, fear about this. It was around the time that Tim was talking about the gesticulations. And so I thought maybe you were worried that, you know, the Italian classic gesticulation was something that was...
I support that, by the way. I will say in workshops all the time, you know, gestures are not bad. All of these things are, they're good. It's, are we doing them in a way that helps or a way that distracts? That's all there is to it. It's not do it or don't do it, but it's about understanding what it is you're doing. If it's helping you, keep doing it. If it's not, what's an alternative approach for you? I love to say in workshops, and I still do live training. We use presenter in there, live training all the time. I will say if you're Italian or Greek, you gesture a lot. If you're from the Northeast, you might gesture even more, add that onto it. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a part of who you are. It's, those things actually help you articulate your message. It's that if I'm doing it in an environment where I'm doing this really big with my arms and making grand gestures and movement, that may not fit the situation or the person you're interacting with. And sometimes we just have to be really focused on what makes it good for the other person. How do I manage that on my end so that I make it more comfortable for them? Because at the end of the day, it's not about me being the most comfortable. It's about me making you more comfortable. I'm secondary.
Right. Those of us from the Northeast sometimes tend to gesticulate with a particular finger, but I'll...
Yes.
So
that is true. That is true. We never talk about the thumb thing.
We didn't talk about the thumb thing. So tell me about the thumb thing.
Yeah. So the thumb thing, I don't assert that I have this down 100%, but here's my recollection. I believe Bill Clinton was a very big finger pointer. And one of the things I remember the very early onset of hearing them do and working with him was to make a fist and put the thumb down on the top, like you were holding the button down, so that he didn't point the finger, because it becomes accusatory. When you point a finger, oftentimes it's not meant that way, but it's perceived as accusatory or disciplinary. Which, think about it, I know my mom, when I did something wrong, she's pointing a finger at me and giving me the daggers through the eyes, and I love her for it, but that finger pointing means something. What I recall is, in order to break him of that, it was make a fist and hold your thumb down. And not point the finger.
And it caught on wildly, though. It's such, as I said, it's an unnatural
crazy
motion.
Now all of them do it. And now it doesn't seem very genuine because everybody does
That's right. That's right. It seems obviously forced and artificial. So Marco, as you probably know, was once a TED speaker. And I'm wondering if you guys have formally studied the TED speaker dynamic and method. I mean, there are differences among the speakers, but there is also, they seem to fall into sort of a narrow window.
They do have a very regimented pathway that they put you on. I have not studied it. I do know that it exists. I know that they have a training curriculum, if you will, if you want to do a TED talk. They like you to go through this sort of process and flow to perfect and refine how you deliver that. I haven't assessed it. I think that goes to your point of is there one right or wrong way to do it? It's the ability to understand what it is that I'm doing in that environment, if it's right or wrong. But if that's how they want it done for that culture, for that environment, for that methodology fits that practice, then who am I to say that's right or wrong?
So I'm curious here, Marco, what are some of the things that you had to learn or that they suggested you do or do differently for TED? And Tim, are those,
good question.
You know, once Marco gives you some of these examples, are these things that presenter picks up?
I will tell.
It's a two-parter.
Very few, very quickly. So in terms of the body language, the one thing they insist on is that they do not want you pacing up and down. So there's a circle, there is a lighted red circle on the floor, and you have to stay within that circle. And they tell you, if you want, you can turn once in a while, turn to a different side of the audience, but never, never pace around. Either than that, they don't seem to want to constrain your hand waving and otherwise upper body gesticulation. At least they did not express that concern overly with me. They do force you to go through different rounds of rehearsal, which I found very unnatural because I prefer to improvise. But what I found interesting, which also speaks to one of the points you raised, Tim, is that they have this system where there is always something listening to your rehearsal, and there will be somebody who is with you throughout the process. But at every rehearsal, there will be somebody new, a fresh set of ears and eyes who hasn't seen you before. And towards the end of my process, this person was coming in fresh, listened to the speech, which by then was fairly smooth. And she said, sounds great, but there are a couple of places where you are not using your own words. Huh. And it shows. And I thought, I have this speech memorized. How can you tell?
I've never heard it. How many times? I've got it.
But I knew exactly what she meant, and she was right. And so you mentioned earlier that you can't force yourself to go too much against your nature in terms of if you are used to gesticulating, don't force yourself to speak with your arms in your pockets because it will show. And I think that was something similar. Don't force yourself to use a language, expressions which are not yours, because it changes the way you speak and the way you come out. That I found very interesting.
Yeah, I can tell you right now, Marco, if I took your arms and I strapped them down to your side and you weren't able to gesture, this would have been a debacle. It just would not, you would not be yourself. You would not be able to express or produce the thought process that you're very comfortable in doing. And that's the part about making this very authentic. It's about letting the best parts of each person come out with an understanding of what the fundamental elements are that we're trying to improve. Everybody has their, you know, on the scale where they should fall out. It just means that we know in this area, this outcome will happen if you do things this way in this area. To your point, to your question, so the big circle and the movement, do I support that or do I not support that? I do support that, and I'll tell you why. It's a different approach, but what I know to be true is when you see, if you're watching somebody give a presentation or a speech, and you know, you've got the TED Talk stage up there, and you see somebody constantly moving back and forth, what we look for is what's the meaning in that movement? Is there intentionality? And most of the times, it's not. It's a reaction to the adrenaline rush in your body. And I tell people this all the time. About 20 or 30 minutes before you do a presentation, whether you're familiar or comfortable with it or not, your body goes, you know what? We haven't done this in a while. Let me just give you a little shot of adrenaline. And that adrenaline starts to course through your body, and it manifests itself in several different ways. For some people, it's pacing across the stage. We know the general feedback on pacing. If you're not moving without any meaning or intention, it's just wandering. It's that adrenaline working its way out of the body, so you look nervous. Something you said earlier is that the person who is giving you feedback said, I can see that's not what you're comfortable saying. How do they see words? How do they see that that's not the language you wanted to use? So it just goes to show you, we have an outward display that I see you and I hear you, and that accounts for the largest portion of the equation in contextualizing your content. We know if the delivery doesn't match the content, and we'll always go with the delivery, and that's what you just supported. They said, I see you're not using language that I don't see language. How's that possible? So what we're doing is understanding that we receive messages all the time. It's how we articulate it and process it back to you. That's one of the things that I think is important about presenter. It's to remove that subjectivity. The software should never say, or feedback should not say, I see you doing this wrong. Here's something that's objectively observed, and we're using a numerical value at which you can now affect that number.
Excellent.
Tim, this has been really fun, and I want to let you go. But before we do that, anything you want to leave us with? One of the questions we often ask our guests is, you know, where do you see the future of your technology in, you know, 10 or 20 years. So that or anything you want to leave us with.
Oh, thank you. Well, first of all, this has been a true pleasure. I cannot believe the time flew by and I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for having me on. If I were to answer the question, where do I see it in 15, 20 years? My goal, my lofty vision would be that it is something that is a learning mechanism from the moment a child can play a game or interact with software. And I can only imagine how that will be in 5 years, let alone 15, but to truly help people communicate better in every way. If there was a way to create a world where people were not scared of talking in front of others, whether it's informal or formal, that would be my ultimate dream. Be brave about what you have to say and know that it's okay.
It's a great final quote. Thank sure. you for that. And thanks again.
Thank you guys so much. Great. What a great podcast. I'm excited to listen to it as well.
Thanks very much, Tim. And actually, let me point out a shout out to your podcast as well. Your co-founder, Tammy, and yourself also have a podcast on your website.
Thank you. Yes.
Very, very enjoyable to listen
yes,
to.
We will have to reciprocate and bring you guys on and talk about that. We do have a podcast, Figures of Speech.
We'll have to practice.
We have the best time. Don't practice. You're just fine. But yeah, we'll definitely have to meet again over coffee talk.
Awesome. Thanks again.
Thank
Tim.
You guys.
All the best.
Appreciate Take it. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Curious enough to know what Marco and I think about Presenter? Stick around for our post-game show coming right up. Marco, what'd you think of Tim Wickstrom?
So I thought Tim was great. I think he is a walking, talking advertisement for the value of Presenter as a tool to improve your presentation skill. But I have to confess, Michael, that my strongest reaction throughout the episode was to think, yes, this really proves Michael wrong. In the sense,
is that what you always think? That's
no, it occurs rarely, which is why I was getting so excited. but what I meant, what was running through my mind was, okay, if there are a number of large companies which are investing what I expect are significant sums of money to deploy services like Presenter, so to help their workforce become more conversant and improving their presentation skills, it means that they definitely don't expect to be firing 90% of their workforce anytime soon. So I took that as being strong evidence against the case that mass unemployment is coming because of technology.
I see. I think if you really want to go there, you could argue that it's a hyper discount rate and they're just assuming that all of the near term will be, you know, heavily weighted towards human needed interaction, and the long term is, you know, just a few years away, but with such hyperinflation, hyper discounting rather, it doesn't really matter to them.
I thought you would come up with something like this. And I guess an even more cynical way of viewing this would be to say that what companies are doing when they give their employees access to Presenter,
they're training a bot to train the people.
It's essentially the service they give you just as they fire you, right? To help you find the new job. Here, by the way, we help you build the skills that you will need in your next job interview after we fire you in a couple of years. That's right. That would probably be the most cynical interpretation.
Oh, man. Yeah, you're right. I'm disappointed in myself that I didn't go there. but there's also the fact that it's a bot that's training you to speak, right? It wasn't totally clear to me how much human interaction there is in the Presenter company's model. It seemed like there's the app, which is obviously only a bot, or solely a bot, I shouldn't say only a bot. But he did talk about trainings that they do generally. And we didn't really get into that too much, but I gather that there's a little bit more to the model. But yeah, I mean, if you want to continue along the cynical dystopian path, you could sort of envision the bots getting better and better based on what they're recording us humans saying, to the degree that they can just do the presentations themselves, right? So
yeah, and you know, the so my understanding of the presenter model is that it's a mixed model in the sense that they can present offer or provide offerings whereby the technology is accompanied by human training, human coaching and advice. But there is also a wider range of services where you just have the app. So it's the bot, the artificial intelligence behind it, which is what clearly allows it to scale. And in the first time I listened to one of their presentations and Tim was presenting, maybe I just wish I had made the point, but I do think I did make the point, it's ironic that in the discussions on the future of work, often people say, well, most skills will be automated. The robots, the artificial intelligence will do them better. And it's only the human skills, the human interaction skills that will save us. And here we have a robot teaching us the human skills.
Exactly.
So it's just really very, very ironic.
That's exactly right. And you can, again, this, I don't think that the AI underneath their trainer necessarily itself gets better at, I don't think, as far as I know, that they're training that bot to improve its own training or its own, you know, it doesn't have its own speaking skill. But that doesn't seem like it's too many steps removed from what they could do if they're not doing it now.
Correct, except that goes to one of the points that I think are most important, which we raised in the interview with Tim, which is the question of feedback. So how do you know that the way you're teaching me to present is effective? Because if you think about it, for a long time, we've had there are acting schools, there are speaking coaches, so we know that there are ways of delivering speech and presentation which are thought to be effective.
Right.
And you find them in the arts, in the performing arts, you find them on television, you find them on radio. But for something like this, on a professional, in a professional context, you would want to have the feedback. You want to see, okay, you train me to be a more effective presenter. I'm a salesperson. Do I get more business signed on because I've become a better presenter? Am I more convincing? So the one question mark that I had is how easy is it to get to the stage where you can get the feedback which would allow you to measure the performance of the software?
Right. Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I think that in general, there are, you know, there's sort of this divide where there are soft results and hard results, right? It's because the win, let's say, from a good talk is hard to measure, right? It's not like there's going to be an applause meter or something. Because it's a soft or a qualitative measure, providing that feedback can be kind of tricky, especially if it's several steps down the road, right? If you make a presentation that after three reviews and more internal discussions leads your customer to make the purchase, you know, there's no way of really tracing that back to the original sales pitch or whatever.
Actually, here is an idea. Maybe we have to call Tim back if they haven't thought of it already, but I'm thinking of presentations that you and I have given and still give to audiences in contexts where the event is professionally organized, and at the end of your presentation, the audience is being given a sheet of paper or an app. Yeah. Where they rate your presentation. Because you could have the presenter bot listening to you and rating you, and then comparing that rating to the rating that comes from the audience. And that could be a learning mechanism.
That's true. Yeah, that's a great idea. Those little, you know, best of five ratings or whatever, the little stars ratings. Yes. That you get at many conferences or other. Yeah, that's a nice idea. Again, it's still removed from whether it's a feedback measure of how well the talk was received, but it's still not a feedback measure of how successful the talk was in delivering its ultimate aim.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. And I guess when the talk is rated today, the rating will probably depend on the content as well as the delivery. So unless the assessment sheet is detailed enough that it allows you to distinguish the two, you might have an assessment that says, yep, this was a great talk, I really enjoyed it, as opposed to, wow, the content was really informative, but the delivery was terrible.
Right, right, right. I want to switch gears for a second. You know, I was trying to think of the sort of larger impact of Presenter. I really had fun with the conversation, and I think it's a cool app. It seems like it's a good company. I think for this company, unlike many of the other companies we've interviewed so far, it's harder, at least for me, to see the kind of broader economic impact or, you know, future of work impact. I see that it's an app that has a business implication, but the outcome somehow isn't as fundamental as, you know, material science or 3D printing or whatever. And I'm wondering if you see it differently.
See, at the very least, it's harder to measure, which goes back to the feedback and performance we discussed earlier. The fact that you have companies investing in it confirms the fact that they expect it to make a difference. And, you know, we have evidence in various behavioral studies of how the delivery, the presentation of content, the sales pitch presentation makes a big difference for a given content. So that leads you to think it should have an impact, but it's very hard to measure. I agree with you. It's very, very difficult to measure. And my hope is that if it gains traction, then a lot more time and effort will be invested in figuring out how do you measure the return on this investment. And then we will be able to understand how much of a macro impact it has. It's interesting because it matches the idea that interpersonal skills will be more and more important in the future of work. Seems to be in line with giving it greater emphasis and helping people, at least helping their interpersonal skills. But I agree with you. It's difficult to say, to look at it and to say, yeah, I can see how this will improve productivity. I can see how this will result in new products, in bigger and greater things. And, right. And as I say this, Michael, I don't know if part of me was upfront and honest in bringing it up in the interview. Part of me is concerned.
Is there a mea culpa coming?
There's something bad coming, in the sense that I am deeply concerned that we have already entered an era where form matters a lot more than substance everywhere. And so to look at something that is so focused on form gives me these dystopian nightmares where I'm surrounded by people who give me very polished speeches and effective presentations, and they're saying nothing. And I can't sleep anymore since we've had that interview.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the form over function problem, you know, I think it's not, no pun intended, it's a function of media and communications generally. And so, and I don't think it started with social media. I think it started, you know, much, much, much earlier, but certainly is accelerated by and exacerbated by the YouTube age and the Twitter age, right? I think the idea that the number of retweets or likes or whatever you get is important, and that is itself related to as much as how you say it rather than the content. I mean, Twitter is really the poster child for this. You know, I know it's no longer 140 characters, but at its origin, having to just put a bumper sticker as the main thing you're trying to communicate was in some sense awful.
Yeah, but in some ways, it was it was a useful forcing function, and there is nothing wrong with being able to effectively convey important concepts in a few words. Oscar Wilde was a master at that, but he was Oscar Wilde. He was not the average Twitter user.
Right. Right.
So
this is he didn't use hashtags.
No. No. But so what is the bottom line here? It looks like the tool is effective, and clearly the company is getting traction with customers, so companies believe this is an important issue. We also discussed in the interview how it might also help interpersonal interactions within the workplace. So if it makes the interpersonal interaction of the workplace more effective, it could help. Without being better able to measure the impact, it's hard to see it as transformational at the same level as, say, 3D printing or new materials. Even though, if it is transformational, it's more impactful in a way, because it has a direct impact on the skills and abilities of people. So to the extent that we worry, can humans keep their place in the economy? This is something that can help them more directly than, say, advances in material sciences or 3D printing.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I also think there's something sort of more democratic about it, right? I mean, everyone can use the tools,
yes.
Right? It doesn't, as opposed to, although the other technologies we've discussed theoretically have a broadening kind of function and appeal over the things they are replacing or the things they are improving upon, you still need to, for example, understand material science a little bit to be able to use a product like Citrine, and you still need to be able to understand manufacturing and part production in order to use a company like Xometry. You still need to sort of be skilled in some sense. Whereas for a presenter, it's obviously much more broad in its appeal. You don't really need a baseline of anything other than verbal ability.
Yeah, and I guess the democratizing aspect also answers my previous concern, meaning that if everybody becomes a good presenter, maybe we start paying more attention to the content.
Maybe.
There you go, dashing my little bit of hope.
You know, look, I'm in DC, and today's headline in the Washington Post was about Nancy Pelosi canceling the State of the Union, or rescinding her offer for President Trump to give the State of the Union. And so I was thinking about State of the Union addresses passed. And of course, there's nothing more polished and more rehearsed than a State of the Union address. But it's also the most artificial of all talks, right?
I can't remember one State of the Union which I liked. I can't stand.
No, they're all terrible. And then, you know, because I'm here, I have this compulsion to watch it. You know, it's horrible. It's a form of self-torture. But those, you know, that's an example of a very well practiced and rehearsed speech, you know, written by committee and, you know, with the hand motions prompted and everything scripted, and they're terrible.
But it's a very good point. And it leads to one last remark on presenter, which is the dynamic aspect. It goes back to the feedback and the learning, but whether or not a way of presenting or a speech is effective depends on your own subjective abilities, as we discussed with Tim, on the audience, but it also depends on the background and the expectations, and those can play either way, right? You can have a speech which matches all the characteristics which are expected for a specific setting, And maybe that plays well to the audience, but it can also lead to a kind of rejection on the part of the audience. Say, oh my God, not again. I've seen this 1,000. And now he will point to somebody in the audience and give us the human example. So maybe you'd want presenter to be a bit more disruptive and tell you, yes, that was perfectly pitched, the right tone, the right change of emphasis. But for God's sake, why don't you try to do something different?
Right. Although it'd be interesting, you know, if you had this feedback system for State of the Union where you had half of the room rising every three seconds with thunderous applause and the other half of the room sitting snarling, scowling with arms crossed, you know, what would the bot make of that?
I think the bot would pack up and go home.
Yeah.
I'm not paid enough for this.
This human interaction thing is terrible. I'm out of here.
I'm going to play chess or go. To call me when it's over.
Exactly. All right. On that note, I think that's a good place to close for our review presenter. Listeners, hope you enjoyed this one. Please send us some comments, send us some feedback, give us a rating on iTunes or whatever your favorite podcast app is. And please also check out our Listener's Edge forum on the m4edge.com website. We're interested in what you find interesting, so tell us.
And once again, thanks for being a loyal listener of M4 Edge.